G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Sam Cove.
I'm Peter Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackin.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show, and it's great to be back. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And I'd just like to congratulate Andy Halliday, who we had on the last podcast, who's pretty much nearing the end of his 200-mile dribble from Cardiff to London. I think it's actually 100 miles, but following him on Facebook, it was a pretty tough journey. And I think if you still want to donate to Hockey to Heroes, you can just go to our Facebook page and you'll find all of the information there. Well, today we've got one guest, and it is a young footballer from Western Australia who backed his ability, went to the UK, had some trials and managed to secure a 2-year contract. And we've just come to the end of his first year, so we thought it would be good to catch up with him, and that is Liam Driscoll. And meantime, John, we've got plenty to talk about. There's been so much happening in the world of sport.
There has, and most of it seems to be going on off the field.
Is there any surprise there? Because, I mean, we launched the show in 2005, and I think for a long time, that's over 12 years, we've been questioning the role of administrators. And to me, it's reaching crisis point here in Australia. I think we're headed for a really tough next 12 months in the world of sport in Australia.
Well, especially as professional sport has risen in this country and more money's come into it, for people it's seen more and more as a profession. And I'm not so sure that sport is actually a profession in the same way that being a doctor or an architect is a profession.
Well, we've touched on it. In fact, I think it was only about 3 podcasts ago, I asked the question, were we paying our CEOs too much money? I think there's 4 or 5 CEOs in sport in Australia being paid over $1 million, which to me is way beyond the pale for what they achieve. Now, we've just seen in the last week, we've obviously had the State of Origin, but in the lead up to the State of Origin, how much did it say about the state of the NRL when you have Cameron Smith coming out and he actually said at a press conference about the State of Origin, if you can't run a game with $192 million, that's fairly concerning. Is there the wrong administration in, or are they spending money badly? So you've got the NRL players, they're up in arms about where the TV money is going. We've also got the A-League owners that are up in arms saying they want a bigger share of the TV money. We've got the cricketers wanting a bigger share of the sponsorship money. And I believe we also have Australia's hockey players wanting a bigger share of the sponsorship money that comes into that game. So that's 4 sports we're talking about. We haven't even gone near rugby union because that's another kettle of fish. But I think the concerning thing for me, John, is the administration. Now, as you touched on there, we've got people with sports management degrees that are getting jobs. Some of them have absolutely no knowledge of how a sporting club is run and what it goes to put a sporting team on the pitch and all of the other things. And I have a big issue with that. I think these degrees are being created by universities because it will bring in students and it will get that money through their doors. But what's coming out at the other end, and it was getting jobs in positions and making decisions on the effect of sport. And we've seen it in football in this state with the national Premier Leagues. You know, here was a decision made by sports administrators and it's now costing the game phenomenally. Like, there are clubs in WA that are likely to go broke at the end of this season, clubs that have had a history of 50 years. Some of that, let's be fair, is bad management on their part. It's not solely the administrators, but again, that is club administrators not running things properly. But what worries me is all this money, again, is based around television. Now, if you're running a sport, should you not be going out and getting other money, other revenue streams that are going to support the game? To me, there's way too much reliance on television sponsorship. And I question where the other money is coming into these sports. Are they getting enough in to support, A, the administration staff, and also to support the game as a whole? And I don't think there is. I mean, if we look at some of the sports, and I've looked into them, the sponsors you see on the websites are the national sponsors for the national team. But then it's been, and that's on the state bodies, on their websites as sponsors. And you look at who are actual sponsors of the games locally, there aren't many, and I just question whether they're bringing in the money, and are they sorting out the revenue streams to support the game, or are all of these sports living beyond their means? As we've seen with cricket now, they've announced that they made a loss on the Big Bash. So cricket, what is going on there? Because the Big Bash is your flagship. That is, as one person in cricket said in the last couple of weeks, the Big Bash is their focal point for the whole summer. That is the one time they need to focus on the game. Now, that only lasts 6 weeks. So if that's their sheer focus and that's losing money, then cricket's in big, big trouble.
Well, like you, I was staggered to hear that the Big Bash was a loss-making exercise for Cricket Australia. Considering how much hoopla's been thrust forward in our faces about how successful this competition is, maybe that figure is actually, for the first 2 years, it cost us $60 million to get the whole thing up and running, and actually since then we've made $25 million. Next year we're going to make an absolute killing. There's no breakdown of how those figures were arrived at, but it's still worrying. I mean, that is the flagship of Australian cricket. I mean, they're talking about the next Big Bash rights deal is going to be worth more than what Channel 10 is worth as a company. So,
But John, I honestly question that, because I don't think that the TV companies are going to shell out all the money that everybody's talking about. This may be the last big deal. Cricket Australia may be the last one to get that. But, I mean, we've just seen the FFA do a deal with Channel 10 based on the fact that everyone's saying Channel 10 will lose the Big Bash. But again, if you look at the actual deal that's there, and we don't know the finer details of it, they're taking all the Fox commentators. So they're basically taking the live feed from Fox Sports, and it's just going to be aired on One for Channel 10. Now, so that's no production costs whatsoever to Channel 10. They're just lifting it straight from there. So that's fine for them. And as everybody says, or people that I know in football are saying, what it is really is Channel 10, as the deal, will market the game. They will promote the games on a Saturday to promote the A-League to try and pull in viewing figures. Because the viewing figures on SBS were diabolical. If it was an actual normal sitcom or a drama, it would have been dropped because the figures were that bad. And again, if you look at the NRL, they're saying crowds are down, participation is down. If you look at cricket, participation is down. If you look at soccer, participation is up, crowds are down. So again, it's a very difficult one, but I think a suggestion that was put to me is what they need to maybe look at, and I know television doesn't work this well, is if the game is not sold out, it shouldn't be aired live in the town where it's being played or the city that's being played. Now, I think there's actually some merit in that. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of merit in that. And I think, to me, that is the thing that could save sport in Australia, is a television station making a decision like that.
Well, I was staggered when they dropped that provision. The other side of it was, at the same time, if the ground was sold out, we were to get a live coverage, and that didn't happen either. So it seems to me sometimes as well that administrators are prepared to make decisions about what happens on the field, but don't apply the same criteria to making decisions off the field. Now, you'll often hear people involved in club sport, etc., they don't want to go out and get a greenhorn coach. You don't want to go out and get a guy that hasn't been and done the hard yards and understands how systems work and has been an assistant coach here and maybe a manager here and done these different things. But they seem to be able to think that they can just drop administrators into positions without having the same background in the sport. I mean, and we've seen what happens when you drop, as credentialed as a player they might be, when you drop a person into a coaching position that doesn't have a solid background in coaching, that's just a big name, they fail. Very, very, very few of them ever do very well. And what we're seeing is people coming straight out of universities with degrees, much like players with fantastic playing records, who are being dropped into positions that they have no real idea about. They don't have a background in it.
Well, I've got to say, you see it as well in television and the media. You know, there are players that have had outstanding careers and they're absolute lemons when they go on television or on radio. It is not that easy for some people to do it. And there are some people that can do it. There are some people that can't. It's just like there are some good administrators. But I think, to me, a lot of these administrators need to go in and have some time at club level and actually see how it works. And this is the problem that we've got, is they've never been at a club. They've not, even if they volunteered at a club, and just see what goes into putting on a match on a weekend. You know, you play hockey at Fremantle,
yeah.
And again, there are volunteers down there who help get the pitches ready. They help do clean the change rooms. They do all the stuff behind the scenes. And I don't think people realise how much goes into that. And the sad thing is, what is happening now is a lot of those volunteers are dropping away from the game because they're seeing players demanding more money, even at local club level, and they're going, well, hang on a sec, why are you paying that guy $300? I'm here from 7 in the morning till about 5 o'clock at night. I do it for free. I don't get any thanks. And on that point, I just want to mention UWA Soccer Club last week, UWA Nedlands, after the Western Knights game, hats off to them. They went up to the volunteers in the kitchen and the bar and said, thank you for the food and thank you for the drinks. And I haven't seen that at a sporting club in this state probably for 10, 15 years, and I thought it was first class. But again, what's happening is the volunteers are dropping off now, and we're really getting into a really difficult situation, because if they're not there, who's going to do it?
Well, no one. Because it won't happen. And volunteers are the backbone of any sporting club. Even the biggest professional teams in the world have an army of volunteers that do work for nothing, that allows these clubs to pay dim-witted, over-talented idiots pack huge packets of money.
But I'll tell you something, John. When I was playing first-team cricket in the UK, this was in the 80s, and we all had a roster where even if you're in the first team, you had to go and help. And it would be, sometimes it would be your job to go there on a Thursday night or whatever to roll the wicket for the weekend, or you had to get there early to do the white line around the pitch, to do the boundary line. And then we all had to do the tees at least once or twice a season. It was your job. They would give you the money and they would tell you what you had to buy and what you had to prepare. And the only thing I would say is I made probably the worst cricket tee ever, that they never asked me to do it before. And one of the things I didn't know, because I was very young in those days, I forgot to wash the lettuce, so the lettuce in all the sandwiches was extremely gritty, and that was why I was not asked to do it again. So I had to tend to stick to the manual labour.
Well, even you mentioned Fremantle Hockey Club, Thursday nights, every team each week on a Thursday night, teams rostered to cook meals. And now it must be said, because of the nature of training schedules for turf teams, etc., etc., those meals aren't actually for the few senior players that go down and train on a Thursday night. They're for the juniors. Most of the meals are eaten by the juniors at 6 o'clock. They come up after their training, and it creates a wonderful environment for a sporting club when you can have that sort of thing happening. And there's no reason why it can't happen at a place like, say, the Western Force. And that they can have a junior club come along and train on the same ground at make up these things. I'm sure that there'd be issues involved, but I'm sure that they could also arrange them as well. And to get grassroots support and connections with the grassroots.
The thing to me, John, is I think in a lot of sports, not all, because I think the pay is ridiculous. Like what the players are getting for what they do is got to a point where it's almost obscene. Certainly the English Premier League is a prime example of that.
Football at the top level, full stop.
Yeah, it's disgraceful. I mean, what I think we need to sort of see happen, and I was really pleased to read two articles in India this week about Gautam Gambhir, the cricketer, and I've forgotten the hockey player, but both of a retired hockey player. They've both come out and they are now sponsoring schools. So they are paying for the education for all these children. One of the hockey players adopted 21 young girls to put them through their education. Now, if you look at the money these guys are earning, they could easily sponsor young players or sponsor young clubs. Now, you think, you know, the money that they are earning, like £120,000 a week or whatever, how difficult would it be to say, go to a club in the area where they grew up and go, I'm going to sponsor your club for this season or the next 3 seasons, and how much that would help bring through the next generation of players. And I just think there needs to be a little bit more altruistic view from these guys. And I would rather see, of this money that we're talking about in the NRL, $192 million from the TV deal, I would rather see that spent on grassroots and getting that all shored up, having a strong foundation so we can build the next generation. If we give it to the players at the top and all of that, trust me, there will not be another generation coming through. The money needs to be spent to develop the next people and set up places for the kids to play, to make it easier for them to play.
Well, one cow makes a small quantity of milk and an even smaller quantity of cream. Three cows make more milk and even more cream. And if you can get 100 cows, well, you've got a big bucket of cream there.
Absolutely. I never knew you were a farmer.
Yes, well, one of my many hidden talents.
Hi, I'm Zocco Calitz, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and appropriately we had Zocco Calitz there, former Socceroos goalkeeper, and our guest on the podcast this week is a man that, well, he may have the chance to play for England and he could also play for the Socceroos, but I think at the moment his loyalty is very much with Australia. And I'm talking about a young gentleman from Perth who backed himself and went over to trial in the UK and then landed himself a two-year deal with Reading in the Championship, and that is Liam Driscoll, who I caught up with a couple of days ago. Liam Driscoll, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hello.
Well, it's good to catch up with you, Liam. You're over there in the UK and you've just finished your first season with Reading. Just wanted to maybe get a little bit of an idea as to what your football background was here in Perth.
I played for Balcata for quite a while, and then I went on to move to ECU for a year, and then I went to play for Bayswater for about 2 years, I think, and that's when I moved to England after that, shortly after that.
And was it a case of you actually deciding to, you know, push yourself and try and get trials over there, or was there somebody else organised that for you?
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's something I've always wanted to do, but my dad's helped me a lot throughout the way, sort of thing. Like, he's definitely pushed for it as well.
And I mean, can I ask which team you support? Because you've got a slight English accent still.
Yeah. I support Liverpool, but that's just through my dad. Didn't really get a choice.
So did you look to trial there, or were you looking at the lower divisions, and how did you come up with, you know, which clubs to try and get trials with?
Well, I was actually supposed to sign for Crystal Palace, but that fell through. And then after that, there was about only a few months until, like, the season started, so we're quite desperate in finding a club. So I trialled at Swindon, which were League One at the time. So he went quite lower, but then my dad contacted the goalkeeper coach at Reading and then sorted the trial out through that way. And then, yeah, did well there. So,
I mean, how did the trial go? Because obviously, as an outfield player, it's very different. You know, they get a chance to have a game and you can see them in action. As a goalkeeper, I mean, you could have a trial game and not have a shot to save.
Yeah, it's purely through, like training, and then, like, attitude as well is massive. Like, how you are off the pitch, they'll judge you, like, a lot on that, and, yeah.
And, I mean, did somebody prepare you for that and sort of say, you know, look, these are the things they're going to be looking for, so make sure you're really on your mettle on those things?
Yeah, my agent at the time sort of helped me through that. Like, he sort of said, like, what they're looking for and how to impress and all that sort of stuff, like, off the pitch. So, yeah, I sort of had an idea of what was going to happen.
And how long did you trial with them for?
It was about a month, I'd say.
So quite a long process.
I stayed in England for an extra 2 weeks after the first 2 weeks. So, yeah, it was about a month.
And when did and how did you find out that they were finally going to actually offer you the chance to stay?
I was actually, just before I went out to training, someone said that, like, they want to see you in the office, sort of thing. So I went in there, like, had no idea, and they just, like, the coaches were inside and saying, we're going to offer you, like, a two-year scholarship. So that's how I found out.
Did you manage to sort of not leap in the air and go, yay?
Yeah, it was very difficult not to do that. But no, yeah, it was probably one of the best feelings in the world at that point.
And what was your training session after that like? Was it one of the worst you've had?
Yeah, honestly, I was shocking that day, but yeah, I couldn't believe it, to be fair, because it was like a dream come true sort of thing. But it was difficult to concentrate.
No, I'm sure it was. That's why I said, was it probably your worst? Because also, I'm sure having been so focused, you would have almost relaxed a little bit as well.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, like all your goes out the window sort of thing.
I mean, that's one of the hardest things we hear. So many young players like yourself, they suddenly get that contract and they think they've arrived, but obviously there's still so much work has to be done, which I'm sure you found out this year.
Yeah, well, that was probably one of the easiest stages sort of thing. As hard as it was, that was like, in terms of like the ladder and going to the first team, that's probably the easiest stage that it is. And then it just gets harder from there.
And do you train with the first team keepers at all?
A few times this year.
And how has that been?
It's good. Like, as soon as you go there, like, the tempo just rises sort of thing. Like, you know, you can tell straight away sort of thing that you're with them sort of thing. But, yeah.
Is that really when you sort of, it's a great benchmark for you because you can then sort of almost monitor yourself how far you've come and how far you still have to go?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you see the first team keepers and, like, obviously they're very, like, good technically in that. So it's a good, like, marker to set and goal to set of, like, where you want to be sort of thing.
You were saying before how it's fantastic to be doing something you love every day. I mean, has there been any moment where you've woken up one morning going, oh, my gosh, I don't want to do this again today? Because the weather can be cruel over there as well.
Yeah, no, the weather is quite bad here, to be fair. But no, I don't think so. I can't remember a day where I've been like, look, I actually don't want to go in sort of thing. Like, yeah, no, I wouldn't say I have, actually.
And what have been the things that Reading have had you working on to improve your game?
Probably my physical side mainly. I'd say that's a big one. When I first got here, it was like technically a lot, but over the past year, I've done a lot of physical stuff and, yeah, tried to get stronger and that sort of thing.
So is that work in the gym just to build your physique up?
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, that's quite a difficult thing because it's very focused, isn't it? Because there are some players who think you just go to the gym, you pump weights, but it is very focused to make sure you don't lose your ability to jump, you don't lose your speed as well.
Yeah, it's a lot like football-biased gym sort of stuff. Like, they give you, like, special programs and that to do. So, yeah, you always know what you're doing in there.
And how do you find that? Because I know a lot of sportsmen hate doing the gym work.
I actually enjoy it, to be fair. Like, I've noticed like it's going to be a massive part of my game, like my physique. So, like, in order to make it the highest level, I need to sort of do this work now sort of thing. So I actually enjoy it.
Now, the interesting thing I find is you haven't come home in the break in the summer over there. Is that because you're still working over there to get maybe your physique better or still training as well to make sure you're in peak condition?
Yeah. Both sort of thing. I've been doing the gym every day since I've been like staying here, and then obviously doing a few training sessions here and there just to like keep me ticking sort of thing in the summer. But mainly the gym sort of stuff to really like push me on.
How difficult has it been for you to be away from your family and friends, or have you been able to focus so much on the football and you're enjoying it that much that it's not been so difficult?
Like I don't know how I like sort of I thought it would be a lot harder than it is, but just concentrating on football and like you said, like it sort of just takes your mind off things back at home, so you don't really think about it at all.
Well, following your dad's been posting sort of your movements throughout the season, what would you say in the past season's been the highlight for you in that first year at Reading?
Definitely making my 23s debut. That was definitely my highlight. I've never, like, when I was on my first year, doing my first year scholar at Reading, I never thought I'd, like, come this far. Like, I'd I was thinking like I really need to get into this, like the 18s team at the time. So I wasn't thinking of pushing on further sort of thing, which was a mistake by me. But yeah, probably definitely making my 23s debuts my highlight.
And I mean, what are you now? 19, isn't it?
18, yeah, just turned 18.
So just turned 18. So playing under 23s at 18, that's a really good sign. And I mean, you played more than the one game in the under 23s, didn't you?
Yeah, I also came on against Arsenal, who played about 5 first teamers, including like Debuchy, Holding, and all those players, Iwobi, and all those sort of players. So that was a great experience playing against them.
How difficult is that? Because, you know, it's very easy when you're a young player who's seen all these guys on television to almost become overawed. I mean, did you find you got yourself in the right headspace and go, look, they're just footballers?
Yeah. It's quite difficult to do that, like, especially when, like, as a goalkeeper on the bench, you're not really expecting to come on. So you're sort of just, like, enjoying the game sort of thing. But, yeah, as soon as, like, you need to get into the right headset as soon as like you're coming on sort of thing and realise that there's just 11 players on the park, like same as your team. So, yeah.
Is that something, again, that your goalkeeping coaches work on, is making sure that if you are on the bench, you know, you are in that right headspace?
Yeah. It's always important to, like you said, be in the right headspace, because when you need it, you need to perform sort of thing.
So where to now for you? I mean, you've got another year with the academy, I believe. And then is it a case of just impressing and keep on pushing on to hopefully get a permanent contract?
I think this year will be like a massive year, as it'll be my first professional, like being as a professional player sort of thing. But I'm hoping to go out on loan to hopefully a South Conference team, which was a very high level, so especially as an 18-year-old keeper. So that's my goal to do this year, and like perform well like on a regular basis, and then see where I go from there, really.
I would have thought as well, if you've made the progress that you have so quickly at the moment, that the sort of scouts around the country would already be aware of what you're doing, and you may actually get even, you know, some of the clubs in the lower divisions in England looking at you as well.
Yeah, I noticed like a lot of the lower divisions, like the keepers there are like really old sort of thing, so they normally just look for experience. But yeah, it's quite difficult as a keeper, because as a player, like going like to a lower division is quite easy, but as a goalkeeper, the lower you go, like the more physical you have to be, which isn't the strongest part of my game at the moment.
What would you say is the strongest part of your game?
I'd say just reading the game, like playing the game, like playing out with my feet. Then also just like, yeah, just positioning wise. And yeah, so that's my strongest part.
You know, you mentioned there you've only just turned 18. If there was any other sort of budding goalkeepers who are looking to go over to Europe, what advice would you give them in terms of preparing for a trial in England or Scotland or anywhere else in Europe?
I'd say mainly just be confident and like believe in yourself. Like I feel confidence is a massive thing, because as soon as you get a bit of confidence going, like you literally feel amazing. And that's what I felt when I first started at the academy. Like I wasn't confident at all, and you could probably see that in like some training sessions and games. But over the time, I've been getting a lot more confident, and like being around the boys, like adapting to it all, and it's just like come out in my performances sort of thing.
I mean,
so I'd say confidence is a massive thing, because the coaches will see that as well.
It's probably a fairly obvious question, but how much do you think you've benefited from top quality training every single day?
Yeah, like a lot. Like I can't even imagine think where I'd be at if I stayed in Australia sort of thing. Like coming here was definitely the best pathway to do sort of thing for me, especially.
Well, it sounds like it's all going well, Liam, and we wish you all the very best, and we'll continue to follow your progress, and hopefully I can maybe have a chat with you again and we see how your first year as a professional goes.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, cheers for that.
Look, thanks very much for your time and all the best.
Yeah, thanks for that. Bye.
Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, there was my hero growing up just down the road from where Liam Driscoll is playing his football. He is in Reading and Swindon is just down the road. We used to be in the same division, but as Liam alluded to in that interview, Swindon have dropped down now and there's a big division between us, and hopefully it won't be for much longer, but we'll have to wait and see. One of the things I found really interesting in that interview, John, was Liam's real honesty about it, and also the fact that, as he said there, he's 18 years of age. He's hoping to, he's got a sort of professional contract now, but he's going to have to drop into non-league football to play just to get that experience, because goalkeepers mature so much later. And if he went down into the rough and tumble of Division 1 and 2, where the British scene, they tend to pick older goalkeepers because the league is that much more physical, and he's just physically not big enough at the moment. But I take my hat off as well to him that he didn't come home in the off-season here, that he stayed there to work on that physical side and keep training so that he can achieve his goal. And I think that is real credit to the young man.
Absolutely. And there's a few guys like Liam who are starting to drift into that English system now from Australia, aren't there? I mean, we have at times previously talked about perhaps the lack of depth coming through in Australian soccer, but it seems to be maybe there is some kernels of hope there, and Liam's part of that.
I think there are. There are certainly some players, and they're sort of slipping under the radar, some of them not getting picked up. I mean, you sort of think, well, there was Liam saying he was picked for the under-23s at Reading, and Ange Postecoglou held that camp in Spain, I think it was, for sort of young overseas-based, invited them into that, and I don't think he got a call-up for that. And you sort of think, well, you wonder why, when, you know, that's quite an achievement at 18 to be playing in an under-23s tournament against the likes of Arsenal and Chelsea and Man United.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what goes on in national soccer selections? I mean, we've seen Ange pick a young fella for the upcoming games. And the talk is, well, he's been picked so we can shore him up as an Australian player. You know, he'll get his cap and then he'll be tied to us. And I think it's Bosnia or someone like that's also chasing the young lad up. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But so how much of our selections based around trying to maintain a pool of enough players and not let them escape to other countries at times?
Yeah, and I mean, of course, one of the things that will be very interesting with that is if Australia fails to qualify for the next World Cup, will some of those rethink whether they want to play for Australia, and will they opt to play for which other country they're eligible to play for? And that's one of the things I don't think a lot of people have thought about in Australia. When we qualify for World Cups, everyone wants to be on the bandwagon. They want to ride that train. But if suddenly the future doesn't look so good, we fail to qualify for Russia, and then it looks like we're going to struggle for the next World Cup, you may see some of those players go, you know what, I think I'm going to be better off trying to make it with Bosnia or for Wales or, you know, Scotland or any of those countries.
Yeah, I must admit, I find it difficult to the grandfather deal.
Hey, look, I would play for any country that offered me, seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
If I was offered, the first one that came in, I would go, yeah.
You. But when you get a guy, okay, say your father was English and came to this country, I can understand how, even if you've been born here and grew up here, you might feel that tie to the old. But if it's your grandfather and your father was born here and you're born here, then no, I don't think that qualifies you to play for England.
But that's a strange one, because I can actually explain a little bit, because my family heritage, Morrison is a Scottish name, and our family was Scottish, Irish, and then moved to England when way before I was born. Like, my grandfather grew up in Ireland but moved to the UK. Never saw him because he died when my dad was 5 years old, and that was in the 1930s. But I've always, and my dad will tell you, from a young, very, very young age, I've always had an affinity to Scotland, and I don't support England apart from at cricket. When it's football, rugby, I support Scotland first, always have done, and I wish I'd made a better choice, to be honest, as a child, the way it's gone there. But you can't change that, and I just feel far more passionate about Scotland than I do about England. So, again, whether that's something in your genes, my sister doesn't feel anything for her Scottish side of the family. I mean, I even got married in the family tartan wearing my kilt because, to me, that felt the right thing.
Interesting. That's a topic for another day. But let's move on. Let's move on to the Australian Rugby Union. And I'll tell you what, it's time that board left. It's time they all stepped down and walked out of the building and let people in there who can actually do the job that they're supposed to be doing. This week, well, on the back of all of the stupidity that has gone on with the Super Rugby this season, on the back of all that, this week the ARU announced that they were going to drop the moratorium on player signings, even though they have yet to announce which teams will not be competing in the Super Rugby series going forward. Now, I'm staggered by this decision because what's actually come out is we've already know what the de facto decision is, because they're reporting Melbourne Rebels are signing Western Force players. What does that tell you? What does that tell the player group about what is going to be happening? Now, the ARU have dilly-dallied on this whole situation for far, far too long now. It's destroying lives, it's destroying livelihoods, it's destroying the game in this state. I don't think they realise it. I don't think they care. Yeah, that's probably more to the point. They don't care. And they're a complete joke. Now, you have the press release there, I believe, about the moratorium, or you perhaps not?
I don't actually have the press release now, but I just have, obviously what came out saying that they're going to allow players to sign for other clubs.
Now, does that contain the quote where they talk about the reasons for doing this and the long-term figures that they quoted as the reason for having to remove one of the clubs? If these are the figures you're relying on, why did you expand the competition to start with? You say it's not a knee-jerk reaction. It's based on long-term trends. How long-term? How long have you known about these long-term trends? And why has it taken you so long to do something about it? And rugby union will not be a national sport in Australia. It'll be an eastern state sport. And it will just kill the sport in Perth. And it's an absolute tragedy and travesty. And it's about time that the people at St. Leonard's were held to account for their actions and the decisions they make. And the first way they can be held accountable is by being sacked and stepping down.
Cameron Klein said here about players signing for a team on multi-year deals with a team that is then cut will be relocated to other clubs, given the option of an early release to or have their contracts paid out. Because if we do end up in a situation where there are less teams than there are, then we'll down, and it will be a player by player basis. We're saying to the players, we'll give you the certainty of honouring your contract or pursuing an early release or whatever you happen to want. In some cases, players may be happy to move to another franchise. Now, again, I agree with you that they should all go, they should step aside, and people who actually know what they're doing should come in and take over. But the one thing I think would have been really clever was if the Western Force went out and were really aggressive and recruited, and if they actually recruited a really strong team and said to all these players, look, stay, let's show that we mean business, and then what situation would that put under it? You know, where would that put the ARU? If they had a squad fully signed up on long-term deals.
Well, that's what I was just about to say to you. Why don't the Western Force just go out and sign all of these blokes and say, hey, do you want to make a cheap $300,000? You won't have to do anything for it. All you have to do is sign this bit of paper, because the ARU's guaranteed it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the decision to do this, to me, is the most bizarre thing. And what upsets me, I think, the most about this whole cutting of the Super 18s down back to Super 15s is South Africa, before they made any decisions, they were already exploring where their teams that were going to get cut would play. And it's interesting that today, as we're recording this, it's just come out that Pro 12 up in Europe has invited the Cheetahs from Bloemfontein to be a part of that competition. Now, if the Western Force are the team that are culled, where have the ARU decided that they can go and play? Okay, they may not have their top-level players, but where can this team that you've invested a lot of money in, that the people of WA have invested a lot of money in, that the players, the coaches, everybody that's been involved in the club has invested in some way or another, where are you going to place that club? Where are they going to play?
How much money did the ARU put into the rugby centre that homes the Western Force?
I'm not aware that they put any. I thought it was all the state government.
Yeah, that's what I thought, so, yeah. So we built you a bloody lovely little home there out at Perry Lakes. Thanks a lot, rugby.
Shared now by the glory, though.
Oh, well, they have to share it because the ARU's not giving them any money, is it?
But it's very sad, and it's just a complete shambles. And I think you made a really good point off air, and it's something to be considered. I mean, there is a test match coming up here in Western Australia. Now, if a decision is made that they're going to cull the force, yes, it would hurt WA and whatever, but there needs to be some sort of protest. Now, whether you do what the A-League clubs did a few years ago, where people go into the stadium, and then once the game starts, they get out of their seats and they walk back out. To me, that would be a magnificent gesture to say, we really don't like what you've done to us, and you know we're not supporting it.
Well, it seems like the only people who run the game, all they're concerned about, is the big fat check they get at the end of the day. Honestly, it's no one at the ARU seems to be under threat from the what's happening with the Super Rugby downsizing. None of them are going to be losing their jobs over it. It's players and officials at the Western Force, or perhaps Melbourne Rebels, but not likely, let's face it. It's going to be the Force. I mean,
but the sad thing is, rugby has had a history in Australia of being New South Wales or Queensland-centric. If you look at the very, very first years, and I'm talking going back to the 30s and the 40s and even before that, It was very much Queensland ran rugby in Australia, New South Wales ran rugby in Australia, and then there'd be another coup and Queensland would then get the ascendancy again. But what is sad to me is that we haven't actually evolved from that. They don't seem to appreciate that there are now teams in Victoria, teams in Western Australia, and the game has far more appeal across the nation than just in those two states.
Well, rugby union's also always had the reputation of being the sport of the top end of town. You know, the smart businessmen, those sorts of people, the lawyers, the doctors, etc., etc.
But well, do they only live in New South Wales and Queensland?
Well, I'll tell you what, would you be asking a member of the current ARU board to come and be on your company's board?
I wouldn't, no. Wouldn't want any of them.
No. And yet these are supposed to be the smarties. Well, if you guys are so smart, how did you miss this? How could you possibly have missed this happening if, as you claim, it's based on long-term figures? How smart are you blokes? If I'm a shareholder of a company you're involved with, I would want you gone.
But again, John, this is the scary thing. So you touched on it there. Players' lives have been really, really disrupted. So too have support staff, administrators within those clubs. Yet who's being held accountable for the decision to expand it to Super 18s? We've not heard any person that was involved in that decision come out and say, look, I'm really sorry, we bungled. We've not even heard whether anyone from New Zealand rugby, South African rugby, or even Australian rugby fought against it and said, this is not a good idea. Now, I wrote an article and I've put it out on Twitter. When they announced it, I said, this is the dumbest thing you could possibly do. And the reason that my argument was based on that was because when rugby turned professional in Europe, they expanded and it got too big. And so then they actually have gone the other way and they cut their competitions back. Because what was happening was the top players physically just could not cope with the volume of rugby. And what it also did was it undermined their international teams because they were playing so many games that when it came to internationals, the players were injured and couldn't play, or they were so worn out and tired that they couldn't achieve or perform at the standard they needed to for international rugby. So why did we not, or those three countries, not look at that and go, well, hang on a sec, we're going down the wrong path here because they went there and that didn't work. So why are we now going down a path that didn't work? And that's what annoys me. We keep seeing these administrators make decisions and take sport down paths that have failed in the past.
Especially when you consider how much more expensive a Super Rugby franchise, you know, Super Rugby competition over three continents, how difficult, well, three, essentially it is now three continents, four if you count Asia, how they thought that they could, the cost, they could rein the costs of that in, considering the costs of what, of the reasons that European rugby pulled back on there, that was costing them a fortune. How much did they honestly think it was going to cost their Super Rugby to do this? I mean,
did they do the due diligence?
I obviously not. Painfully, obviously not. They made a decision on a whim and went with it. They were talked into it by some television executive, no doubt. Oh, look, you know what? There'll be another 50 grand in your pay packet when this gets signed, because you'll have all this money floating around. You'll be able to do wonderful things. And it's just pie in the sky rubbish.
Well, I wonder if the IRB didn't twist their arm with the next World Cup being in Japan. It's like, you get a Japanese team in, we'll throw some money your way. And then, of course, Argentina needs to play somewhere because they made the semi-finals of the last World Cup.
And the IRB has been definitely silent on this whole situation. Why aren't they stepping in and saying, hang on, we've got this rugby community here in WA and you're going to destroy it if you carry on the way you're going? And they will. It'll be destroyed. And, you know, it won't be the NRL stepping in. They're not going to take up the slack there. What's going to happen is these kids are going to end up playing AFL. Okay, because if you're playing rugby, you're the sort of kid that loves the physical contest. So you're not going to be running off and playing soccer. You're going to go and play AFL.
Poor kids.
Yep, I feel sorry for them too.
But I just want to finish this podcast because since our last podcast, a very bit of sad news happened. Now, if you listened to the radio show, you would have known that we used to broadcast at the old Australian Rugby Championship, also the Super Rugby, and alongside me in the commentary box was John Taylor, better known as JT, and sadly he's been fighting cancer for a long time and it looked like he'd had it beaten, but unfortunately he passed away between our last podcast and this one, and we farewelled him a couple of weeks ago. And I must say it was an absolute joy to work with him. I hadn't realised how much I had grown to love him as a friend, off air as well as on air. He educated me. He was a brilliant guy to work with. He loved his rugby and he will be sorely missed. And I know the rugby community is mourning his loss. And personally, I will never forget the influence he had on my life. And I'm missing him a great deal.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.